Okay, Proverbs 17. Let's look at verse 23. We'll finish up 17 and go ahead and get into 18 this morning. The last thing we talked about in 22 was the attitude of someone and how it affects others. How a joyful attitude can lift up others. The verse there in 22, a merry heart does good like medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones. So we finished with that, just stressing how important one's attitude is. And just to finish with that, as Christians especially, what impact does our attitude have on those around us?
It really controls the way that others interact with us, yeah, and whether or not they really want to interact with us.
Yeah. It does. Attitude have an effect on how effective I'll be at teaching others the gospel? Yeah, you won't even get an opportunity if the attitude is this second one there, a broken spirit that dries the bones. It won't even be an opportunity to do that. We can make the applications all the way down. What about in our marriages? Attitude have a part to play? Is it important? So, yeah, that, all of that, and right on down with our children, with our friends, in the local church, in the local congregation. It's extremely important to have that attitude of a merry heart. When we come together on Sunday mornings to study God's Word and worship the Lord, are we happy about it? And are we showing it? Because if we're not, what in the world is wrong with us? Something's wrong. If we're not joyful and having a merry heart about it, something's not as it should be. So, again, we finished with those thoughts last time. Let's look at verse 23. A wicked man accepts a bribe behind the back to pervert the ways of justice. And we're actually going to look at a couple verses that are going to talk about the idea of justice and God's role in that, or God's attitude toward that. 23, the Lord is just. So, when you have someone who would pervert justice, how does he feel about it?
It's an abomination.
There you go. That's the word. It's an abomination. It makes him sick. And in this case, you have someone who's not only perverting justice, they're doing it for what purpose?
Monetary.
To make some money. Yeah, they are taking a bribe in order to pervert justice. If you go, mark your places and go to Micah chapter 3. Certainly a problem that the children of Israel had to deal with. Micah chapter 3. As God is giving his warnings out, look in verse 11. Her heads judge for a bribe, her priests teach for pay, and her prophets divine for money. Yet they lean on the Lord and say, "Is not the Lord among us? No harm can come upon us." What about that attitude? What are the ones who should be just? What are the judges doing?
Taking bribes.
Yeah, what are the priests doing?
Same thing.
Yeah, and when it says preaching for pay here, or teaching for pay, I mean, obviously you guys support what, three preachers? They teach and they are supported for it. Is that what this is talking about?
No.
But what are these guys doing? I'll teach whatever you want. You pay me, I'll say whatever you want to hear. That's the attitude here that Micah is warning against. And then verse 12, put it with it. Therefore, because of the way you're acting, because of you, he says, Zion shall be plowed like a field, Jerusalem shall become heaps of ruins, and the mountain of the temple like the bare hills of the forest. Can you imagine him saying that about his own temple? That place, that physical place that he chose for his name to be, it was special. And then under Solomon, he allowed it to be built. And he said, here at Jerusalem, in this place, my name will dwell among my people. And what is he saying about his temple that was precious to him? What's going to happen to it because of the bribery and the lies and the deception? It will be like the bare hills of the forest. It'll be wiped out. And we know that does happen. Twice it happens. So, again, God, just as Matthew said, an abomination when those who would seek to pervert justice. He can't stand it. Okay, back to Proverbs. This Let's look at 24. Wisdom is in the sight of him who has understanding, but the eyes of a fool are on the ends of the earth. Wisdom is in reach for someone who seeks it. Can it be found? Yeah, it's right there, and it's often within arm's length. It's very, very close. But then you've got this second part that says, but the eyes of a fool are on the ends of the earth. A fool can chase after wisdom to the ends of the earth, and he still won't get it. Why not?
Looking for the wrong way.
Yeah, how so? How so?
In the world.
Yeah. Worldly wisdom, Bill?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the passage that says they see that they don't see. They hear but they don't hear.
Yeah.
Something, I'm paraphrasing.
Sure.
That's it.
Yeah. They don't really want it. They think they want it. They like the idea of it. But then when they see its reality, what does godly wisdom require of us? What will it cause to happen in us? I'm going to have to change my life. I mean, and that is, you know, there are a lot of sayings, well, you know, if God really loved us, he wouldn't expect us to change. Why does he expect us to change? The changes he expects and requires, are they good for us? They're good for our souls. That's why he wants us to change. So, you know, don't listen to that kind of, as Norris mentioned, that worldly theology that's out there. But this wisdom is in the sight of him who has understanding. Those who truly want it can have it. It's right there. And they seek it and they're able to find it. Going back to what Bill said, they hear, but they don't really hear. And they see, but they don't really see, because really they don't want what God has to say. If we really want it, it's there. He'll allow us to find it. He wants us to find it. We've already looked at 25 last week, so let's look at 26. This, again, the idea of justice being perverted. Also, to punish the righteous is not good, nor to strike princes for their uprightness. The Lord knows those who are doing His will. And when you have someone punishing the righteous for doing good, again, it's an abomination to Him, something that He hates. This, can you think of those, Old Testament and New, who punished the righteous for doing good?
Yeah.
Let's give some examples.
Jesus.
Was Jesus punished for doing good? Absolutely. Unjustly was he punished. There's the biggest example. What became of, well, let's look at it like this. Let's say the Sanhedrin approved it. What became of that Jewish court, that Jewish council?
Destroyed.
Yeah. What became of their temple?
Destroyed.
What became of their city?
Destroyed.
Okay. What about the Roman Empire, who was the muscle behind it, if you will. The Jews desired him to be crucified. The Romans implemented it. What became of the Roman Empire? You go to Rome today, there's not a Roman emperor in control. They're gone. They're done. They're dust now. What happened to Jesus? Seated at the right hand of the God, of God, ruling over his kingdom. So, obviously there, we see how that ended. We see which side God took in that. And that's the same. To strike princes for being upright, we think of how awful that is. And yet we look around. Is that a reality in society? Are the righteous punished for doing good? See it more and more, and we may see a lot more of it before things are said and done. So again, don't be surprised by these things. Any thoughts on those? Okay, let's look at 27 and 28 together. He who has knowledge spares his words, and a man of understanding is of a calm spirit. All right, let's wait. Let's do that one first, and then we'll look at 28. He who has knowledge spares his words, and a man of understanding is of a calm spirit. Listen and learn. What do the wise do according to this?
Swift to hear and slow to speak.
Yeah, same. We see that admonition in the New Testament as well. Good. Bobby, James.
Well, I would say he he be quiet until it's appropriate for him to talk.
Yeah. The wise know how to listen. And, you know, again, I don't want to start a political discussion, but it is interesting to me that whenever an election year starts to come around, what do you hear a whole bunch of? People are talking, right? Talking and talking and promising and talking and talking. Who's listening? They say they do. Maybe I'm negative, but I have a hard time because all I see and all I hear is the talking and the talking. What do the wise do? They let other people talk. And this is one of those things. You know wise people. There are people that you've grown up knowing and you love them, especially brethren, who are they've just shown their wisdom over the years. When you go to them with a problem, at least in my experience, do they do all the talking? I can think of conversations I've had with an older preacher. Just, you know, things have come up and you have all these questions. Had a 30-minute conversation with him. He said like three things. I talked during the whole thing. And he would just keep prompting me. He said, well, go on. Okay, well, what else? And I just bring up all of these things and all of these issues that are on my mind. And, you know, I list like seven things. And then he goes back to one. And he makes a point. And he doesn't say a whole lot. But the thing is, if I take care of the one, what happens to problems 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7? We don't need to deal with all these yet. Because if you take care of the heart of the problem, all of these others are gone. I couldn't see it because I had word clutter. Right? I'm caught up in all of these things and I'm thinking about this and this. And he just sits there for 15 minutes without saying anything and says that. And then you leave the conversation feeling like an absolute moron. Like, why didn't I see that? Because I was too busy talking about it. He listened. And it was clear. And he saw it. The wise do that. Is there a lesson in that for us? We need to listen. Now certainly, either Les or Bobby pointed out, you need to talk. There are times when you need to speak up and you need to stand for truth. But to know what to say in those times, you're going to have to listen beforehand and learn and soak it up. And what goes with what makes that possible is also there in 27. Look at the end of 27. How is it? What's connected with understanding?
Man uses the phrase a cool spirit.
A cool spirit.
A cool spirit is a man of understanding.
There you go. Okay. I like that. That we understand what that means. The New King James has a calm spirit. Same idea. A cool spirit would be at odds with a hot spirit. If somebody's hot spirited, hot tempered, what are they?
Fool.
they're full. They're explosive and they speak before they even know what's going on. He who has a cool spirit is able to control his emotions, control himself, control his mouth, and listen and learn the things before he acts upon them. This is great wisdom. I mean, this is not only in spiritual things, but just in day-to-day life. This is important. We need to be able to control our emotions. And certainly, it's good to be zealous about something. But make sure you know what you're talking about when you do it. Listen and gain that understanding. 28 goes with it. Even a fool is counted wise when he holds his peace. When he shuts his lips, he's considered perceptive. So the thing is that silence also has another benefit. If I am a fool, if I keep my mouth shut, at least everybody doesn't know it. Because what's the old saying? You know, I'm going to get it wrong. You can keep your mouth shut and have people wonder if you're a fool, or open it and remove all doubts. Right? And it's similar to what's being said here. Even somebody who has no clue, if you just be quiet, at least it'll be better. At least people might think that you're perceptive. So certainly a lot of value placed on listening. And you talk about the old, we mentioned it before, God gave us two ears and one mouth. Do we use them in that kind of proportion? Good. Any thoughts? Comments on 17 altogether. Norris.
Calling, like you said, it's the opposite. It just seems like when you're around a lot of people and the people that are doing all the talking don't know what they're talking about, but the listener is listening to them and paying attention. But you sit there in your mind saying, you just don't know what you're talking about. But yeah. The influence that he has on the people that listen to him is dangerous. And that's why we always say in church, when you listen to people sometimes, the teaching falls, and the thing does say something good. And look how many people that listen to him and go for what he's saying.
Yeah.
You know, and it's real dangerous. That's why we have to be careful when we listen.
It is, and that would be one of those times you listen to hear what a teacher's saying, and then when you realize that it's false, then it's time to speak up. That is the time to stand against it. But to make sure you understand what it's saying, you have to have listened to truth and know what truth is, and then be able to compare it to what he's teaching and realize that there's a difference there. So yeah, again, the wisdom in listening, and certainly courage. Again, not saying we should never say anything. We have to. I mean, so you look at Peter, you look at John. They couldn't help but speak truth. They had to speak it. But be wise. Listen. We don't have to be talking all the time. Good. Any other comments? Okay, let's start in 18. Proverbs 18. Looking at some different attitudes that bring trouble. Let's read verses 1 and 2 together. Someone would like to read those for us, please.
Whoever isolates himself seeks his own desire. He breaks out against all sound judgment. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion.
Okay. Here, you have someone who always wants his own way. You've got a description of a self-willed person. Their way is the way that they consider. He isolates himself. You know, a lot of times, the one who isolates himself it's because he's consumed with himself. It's his ways and the things that he wants. He won't listen to reason from those who would try to rebuke him or correct him. Why? Verse 2, I think, has the answer to that. Why won't he listen?
Listen to his own heart.
He does. His business, his interest, is expressing his own heart. And then if you look at right before that in verse 2, a fool has no delight in understanding. He doesn't actually want to know what's right. He wants to do his way. And those things, it's just not going to harmonize. When you've got God's wisdom versus I want to do it my way, those two don't go together. He would be better off to do chapter 17, verse 28, wouldn't he? Just say nothing. Just be quiet. But he won't do that. He's consumed with himself. This idea of this me first attitude, let's consider some ways that's a problem. Selfishness is what it is. And Matthew and I were studying, I guess it was last week, and we were talking just about some different things. What sin is connected to selfishness? Which one's not? Right? Is pride connected to selfishness? Yeah. What about fornication? Is that connected to selfishness? Adultery? Yeah. Lying? Can you trace that back to selfishness? Often. And you guys can bring it up now or tell me later. There may be some that aren't. But very often, what do our sins get traced back to? Selfishness. And me first. So you consider that attitude of the selfish man. What does selfishness do to marriages? It'll ruin them, right? The whole concept of two becoming one, what does selfishness do to that? It's the exact opposite. It just wreaks havoc on it, splits it right down the middle. If I am a selfish employee, how's that going to affect my work relationship? With my coworkers, with the job that I do. I mean, I may be productive. What kind of relationship am I going to have? Anybody trust me? No, they're not, because I'm looking out for number one always, and I will throw you under the bus if it helps me, if I'm consumed with selfishness. And just going down the line, again, what about the local church? What does selfishness do to a local congregation like this? Yeah, it causes division. I will have no patience with you. I will have no long suffering. I won't try to understand your problems. It'll be always about me, and that'll cause division. It'll cause pain every single time. Okay, good.
No, Les, I think a lot of time about that. I think we don't think about the consequences they have on other people. You know, that's one of the biggest things that. You know, it can have a consequence on a whole bunch of people, but down the line, you know, and I think that's what a lot of people don't think about.
Yeah. If every single day I am a selfish man, Will it be obvious? Be obvious to my wife? Will it be obvious to my children? And if they spend 18 years growing up around a selfish man who is very selfish, what is there a very good chance that they're going to be? And there's a very good chance. Now, everybody has their own free will. I understand that. And they make their own choices. But if I give them the example of being selfish day in and day out, every single day, there's a good chance that they can follow in that path too. Norris is right. It doesn't just affect us as individuals. It affects those. And here's the other thing. How will I be able to serve God if I'm selfish?
You can't.
It's impossible. And I know that's a big word, and a lot of times people shy away from. Well, let's not say it is impossible to serve God if you are selfish, because He expects humility, right? And humility is the opposite of selfishness. There is no way you and I can serve Him if we are just selfish and we put us first all the time. It's impossible. I'm not afraid to use that word in that context, because it goes against everything that He demands and expects of His people. That humbling of ourselves, that bowing before Him, it's not going to happen, because I'm going to put me first if I'm selfish. This ruins every relationship, spiritual, physical. It ruins them all. Betty?
Does it go back to like God being a jealous God, and if you're self-centered, you're not even sharing yourself with God. You're not even putting Him first.
Yeah, I think you can definitely make that point. When, you know, we often consider that idea of Him being a selfish God in the context of not worshiping other gods and not worshiping other idols and things like that. If I have put myself first, what have I made myself? I've made myself my own idol. And Lord willing, in the next hour, we're going to talk about Nebuchadnezzar's idol that he built on the plains of Dura. 90 feet tall, 9 feet wide, made of gold. I might be that golden statue in my life. I could put myself first, and you're absolutely right. Would God be jealous of that if I made me more important than Him? Sure would. Absolutely, He would. Great, great thought, Ben. Good, Norris?
Yeah, I understand, man. You can do this in a lot of situations, but I think, sports, man, you got to. A team of 50 or 60 some players, you got one or two selfish people. Just think about the effect they have on the whole team. And you know, and I like it when I see teams get rid of people like that, because the chemistry, you know, and it's just all kind of problematic causing, because you have selfish people that it's all about them instead of the team. And I think, like you said, with the church, you know, look at how many problems causing you, somebody selfish, like you said, teaches false. Anything like that, you just cause so much problems.
Yeah. What if, I mean, think of the church like a body. And certainly that's how we see it described in a number of places. What if one part of your body took all the nutrients? Well, what if one part just sucked all the life away from the other parts? How healthy would the body be? Yeah. The hand is looking pretty good, because he stole everything from everybody else. But the whole body, as one, it can't function like it's supposed to. It's suffering. I think it goes back to the point Norris made, that selfishness, just trying to take everything. The body doesn't work like it's supposed to. The football team doesn't work like it's supposed to. The chemistry is not there. Same is true in a local church. When you have someone doing that, and that is the incredible balance of when elders... You have elders. Do they have authority over the local congregation? Absolutely. Are they selfish and self-serving? No, they're the exact opposite of that. And that's where you have this position. They have the authority to lead, but they're humble. Does that sound like anybody else?
Jesus.
Did Jesus have the authority?
All authority.
All authority given to Him. Was He humble? Yes, so you've got that mixture. And when I read about what elders are to be and how they're to be, that's what I see. Do they have the authority to lead? Absolutely. What is their goal? To promote themselves? Never. The souls of the saints they're shepherding. That is their goal. That local church, making sure that it is faithful and true and growing. And so you've got that mixture there. And certainly it's the opposite of selfishness. Just... And a physical example, I think we can look at there. Liz?
One of the qualifications
says not to lord over the flock.
That's
and
right.
That's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Bob?
I think Diotrephes had that problem.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. He may be one of the best New Testament examples of that. Just, I mean, you have someone who, if he found out people were involved with the apostles and supporting them, he would just basically try to throw them out of the church. And just, yeah, that complete selfishness. He had puffed himself up and built himself up to this position of leadership. Exact opposite of what's needed. Good. Any other thoughts? Those are good. Okay. Let's look at verse 3. Chapter 18, verse 3. When the wicked comes, contempt comes also, and with dishonor comes reproach. And I take this in context, or I think we can, with the previous two verses. When you have someone who is a self-absorbed man, a wicked, self-absorbed, self-serving man, he brings contempt with him. How does he bring that? How does he bring shame and contempt with it?
A wicked man is not content unless he's sharing his wickedness. Yeah.
So he ends up bringing dishonor. And the second part of the verse is, with dishonor comes reproach. He ends up spreading the dishonor around. And then he's also seen in a contemptuous way, because when you know that someone is like that, is self-serving, is self-absorbed, what's your attitude toward them? Do you draw closer to them? You pull away. There is a certain amount of contempt that can form there, because we don't want to be around someone like that. We know that they'll throw us under the bus at any given opportunity. So this, it has a negative effect in a lot of ways. That's okay. Any other thoughts? Look at John 3. We'll just turn there for a moment. I think this pertains to what we just read in verse 3. Start in verse 19. Jesus is speaking. Notice what he says. Verse 19, John 3. This is the condemnation, that the light is come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone practicing evil hates the light, does not come to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. But he who does the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be clearly seen, that they have been done in God. I think you can make an application from what Jesus says to the wicked man. The wicked man who would bring dishonor and contempt. He hates the light. Why does he hate the light? What does light do? It shows everything. You can see everything clearly in the light. And the righteous, those who are striving after good things, did they have any problem when you expose what's going on? No? Because they're humble, they may not want everybody to know everything they're doing, because they want to keep it low. But it's not because they're ashamed. It's not because it's evil. What about the wicked man? Does he want light to shine on his deeds? No. Hey, turn the light out. I like it better in the darkness. And so that's that idea. We see it here in Proverbs under the old law. We see the idea of darkness and light in the New Testament as well. Just that those who want to remain in darkness cannot stand light. When you come to someone teaching truth and they are in a situation that is a violation of God's word. Let's say they're in, say they're living in adultery, and you bring it to them. You bring teaching on it. Their response is going to identify a lot about their heart. If they don't want it, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. Just go away. What do they prefer? Yeah, they prefer the darkness. Don't bring the light, because I prefer to stay here in the darkness. If when the light comes and shines on it, they realize that they're out of harmony with God's word and their heart is soft, what do? They change and they go toward the light. Whatever changes they have to make. So again, we see the difference in hearts there. We see that a lot in Proverbs. Okay. Actually, we're going to see it in the next verse. Look at verse 4. The words of a man's mouth are deep waters. The wellspring of wisdom is a flowing brook. I believe that verse 4, when it says the words of a man's mouth are deep waters, I believe it's showing a connection to his heart. It's deep because it's rooted in his heart. Those words start there and they come from that. So that's an idea we've seen in other chapters of Proverbs. We see it in the New Testament. Jesus talks about it a lot. So again, this attitude, this idea that there's a connection between one's words and his heart. The second part of that, the wellspring of wisdom is a flowing brook. Turn to James 3. James chapter 3. Get there. Someone will read verse 17 for us.
But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy.
That's that wellspring of knowledge. And just notice the description there. And it is interesting to me that you make the connection here as a comparison or contrast rather with the selfish man. Look at the qualities that are mentioned here in James 3 verse 17. The wisdom that's from above, heavenly wisdom, it's pure. First of all, it's pure. It's not tainted by man-made thoughts or teachings. It is pure. It's clear. It's from the throne. It's peaceable. It's gentle. It's willing to yield. And it's full of mercy. It goes on down. It bears good fruits. It's without partiality, without hypocrisy. That is the exact opposite of selfishness that we talked about earlier in Proverbs. So those two, they cannot go hand in hand. Okay, let's go back to Proverbs 18. Any thoughts on verse 4 or anything else that we've seen? Okay. Verse 5. It is not good to show partiality to the wicked or to overthrow the righteous in judgment. Again, we've kind of talked about this somewhat already. Let's think about some examples where partiality was shown. Jacob and Esau. Partiality shown in the lives of Jacob and Esau. You know, one parent choosing one parent choosing the other. Did it cause problems? Yeah, it caused just a huge rift between the two sons. You can go to James 2, 1 through 9 and look at the example or the partiality being shown between the rich and the poor. And certainly that's condemned.
Joseph.
Yeah. Joseph being... Did that cause any problems with his brothers? Yeah, they hated him. They hated him for... Was Joseph a good man?
Yes.
He was, and it wasn't necessarily his fault, but the partiality shown just really, really caused some problems among him and made a lot of jealousy there among his brothers. Bobby?
It was also shown when Pilate asked the Jews who did they want to let go, Barabbas or Christ.
Yeah.
They chose to let Barabbas go.
Yeah. How ridiculous. Let's choose this murderer and because that's who we want. We would much rather have this guy with blood on his hands than the one who told us things we didn't want to hear. Yeah.
Sure. Peter with the Gentiles.
Yes. Yeah. And there, did he know better?
Yeah.
He did. And that is the thing. And that, again, we've talked about before how Peter's example is such a good one because it is us a lot of times. And Peter, you got in Acts chapter 11, he defends the gospel being taught to the Gentiles. He says the vision that he saw, and this is why I was eating with them, because God has accepted them and they have all the blessings that we have. And then later on down the road when certain Jews came from Jerusalem, he wouldn't even eat with the Gentiles. So again, yeah, great example. Partiality is bad stuff. And can it cause problems in a local church? It can wreak havoc. When you start feeling like cliques are developing and then this group has more influence and this is it's awful. Again, going back to the example of the body, when some of the body's getting all the stuff and the other part's getting cut off, nobody's healthy. And that's what happens with the local group too. Very good. Especially, now that is true, partiality across the board, but especially showing partiality to the wicked is something that is hugely offensive to God. Turn to Nahum. Nahum chapter 1. Let's put that example with it. Jonah, Micah, and then Nahum. So you're imagining one who sides with the wicked and basically stands against the righteous. Even passes judgment against the righteous. He has made himself an enemy of God. And I just want to bring up some things that are taught here in Nahum. Chapter 1, look at verse 2. We'll look at verses 2 and 3. God is jealous and the Lord avenges. The Lord avenges and is furious. The Lord will take vengeance on his adversaries, and he reserves wrath for his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger and great in power, and will not at all acquit the wicked. Now, literally speaking, and specifically speaking, this is a prophecy against Assyria. I understand that. This is against Assyria. But do those principles hold true in other times as well? I mean, verse 3, the Lord is slow to anger. Is that true? Yeah, that's not just true concerning Assyria. That's true across the board. Is he great in power? Yeah, at all times. But he will not at all acquit the wicked. The wicked will have to answer for the things they do. And those who would pass judgment against God's righteous, those who would support the wicked and persecute the righteous, they will face that wrath and they will face that judgment. Any comments on that? Turn to Romans 12. Let's put one more verse with it. I think we can look at this from two sides. Romans 12, verse 19. The righteous don't need to worry and be afraid that God does not see what's taking place. Verse 19, beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. He knows what he's doing. His timing is right, and he will take care of it. And I just go back to that idea in Proverbs. Those who would show partiality to the wicked, what are they doing to God? You get an image of what they're doing? He's long-suffering, right? He's patient. But eventually what happens?
He's done.
The wrath comes. It's like the bear sleeping. And you just go and you take your stick and you just poke him and poke him and poke him. He may not wake up the first couple times. But what's eventually going to happen? He's going to splatter the walls of the cave. I mean, it's going to be vicious when he attacks. And I think you guys remember there was a movie, I think it was from the 50s. It was about World War II. Had to do with the attack on Pearl Harbor. Tora, Tora, Tora. Remember the Japanese admiral, Ishiroku Yamamoto. Ishiroku Yamamoto was the Japanese general. You remember what he said when concerning the United States getting involved in World War II, basically. They bombed Pearl Harbor. The United States was kind of minding their own business. And then the United States got involved. And he says, I fear that what we have done, all we've done, is awaken a sleeping giant. And he goes on to say, I fear that we've awakened a sleeping giant and filled him with a terrible resolution. Not only did we wake him up, we motivated him. And I think we're in trouble. Now, there's some question as to where he actually said that or not, but that is the quote associated with him. Not that God is sleeping. I don't want to give that impression. Does he know what's going on? He absolutely does. He sees all. But he's long-suffering, and he's patient. He gives time. You keep poking him long enough, though. When Babylon continually served their false gods, he had a purpose for Babylon. You see some glimmer of, and I think we'll see it this morning, you see some glimmer of faith even among Nebuchadnezzar. Some of the things he says, he begins to comprehend who God is, but they keep on worshiping false gods. They don't reject the false and totally embrace God. What happened? Medo-Persia comes in and takes over, and Babylon's done. So here you have that same idea. Don't push him. He knows he's long-suffering, but when his wrath comes, it is terrible. Okay. Matthew.
Yeah, I think sometimes we forget exactly how damaging this can be to somebody who is righteous, who sees the partiality towards the wicked. And, you know, I've seen it a lot with families. You'll have children who will be obedient, but it seems like the wicked ones are the ones who get it showered on them. And you can see it in them, you can hear it, and it's just kind of like, what did I do to cause this person not to like me so much? And then even with your friends, you may have a friend that you may go to for help constantly, and they're always there. They're there to help you. But then when the free time comes, you're spending your time among the wicked.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can see it, and you've heard it, that people become extremely discouraged when they see that. It's just kind of, we forget that we show more towards the wicked, and we shouldn't be equally unyoked with them either. But we can really discourage brethren if we don't show that partiality towards them as opposed to spending more with the wicked.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's certainly a warning for parents too, to not show partiality towards our children. You know, we talked about it before. Is it a temptation?
Yes.
But what if one of them is just like you, and they like the same things that you like, and they have the exact same personality? They laugh at all your ridiculous jokes. There's a temptation to kind of side that way. But what does it cause? Jacob and Esau is what it causes. There's a problem. And I wonder if it might be a problem for grandparents too. You know, it is something that I've seen in my own family, that one particular grandchild will be chosen and the others are just, you know. And how does everybody else feel about that one grandchild? They don't like it. And so it's awful. It's a mess all around. It's, as Matthew mentioned, among brethren, it's a nightmare. But among families, it wreaks havoc too. So certainly partiality is something we need to be aware of. Be aware of it and realize that it can happen. Okay, let's stop there. That's good. Good discussion. Thank you, guys. And Lord willing, we'll pick up there next Sunday.